You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Is the United States at war? What constitutes war these days? What even is a declaration of war? Do any of these terms have any meaning? What happens next? So far this afternoon, though there has been a retaliatory strike by Iran against the United States' largest base in the region in Qatar, no fatalities reported, and most reporting this afternoon indicating that Iran effectively gave the United States a heads up that this was coming, which allowed interventionist measures to be deployed. In fact, the most recent reporting I heard this afternoon is that whether it was 14 or 19 missiles directed at the U.S. base in Qatar, not a single one actually hit its target. Apparently, one did fall somewhere on the, but there was nothing there. So we're very, very thankful this afternoon to be joined not only by my fabulous Monday co-host, Matt Rothschild, host of the podcast Wisconsin Forward that you can find here on the Civic Media Radio Network and wherever you find your podcasts, but also Mideast expert Elon Berwin of the American Foreign Policy Council, who joins us again here on this fine program. Matt, welcome. Elon, welcome. So much to discuss this afternoon. Let's get into where we are right now, Elon. What is the current status as you understand things? The United States engaged three specific targets in Iran over the weekend in cooperation with Israel and its military intervention in its fighting with Iran. What were those targets and why were they so important?
Right. So there were three targets, but there was one that really mattered. And this was the uranium enrichment facility in Fordo. It's in western Iran. But unlike the other facilities that were struck, those were Natanz and Isfahan, those were sites that the Israelis had already softened up, that they'd already targeted because they were above ground, they were lightly defended. Fordo was a different matter entirely. Fordo was built into a mountain with uranium processes happening underground. And the worry was, among Israeli planners, was that while they were running a campaign to set back the Iranian nuclear program, they really didn't have the ordnance necessary to get at Fordo. And so the open question was, if the U.S. didn't get involved directly, if the U.S. Sat this one out while Israel was carrying out its campaign, how much could Israel actually set back the Iranian nuclear program if this facility was left intact? And the president, gave his famous, 2 week sort of general 2 week time frame, which he says sort of for everything.
Yes.
He'll make a decision within 2 weeks, but very quickly seemed to come to the conclusion that the only way out is through, right? That neither the U.S. nor Israel nor Middle East security generally benefits from a job that's half done. And so he decided to attack Fordo, to launch to use the GBUs, the massive ordnance penetrators that we have in our arsenal, the Israelis don't have in theirs, as a way of amplifying what the Israelis had already done. The most important context, though, I think, for all of this is the president did this and the ancillary strikes on Natanz and Ford and Isfahan for good measure, really as an element of coercive diplomacy, as in this wasn't an attack to change the Iranian regime. This was very clearly, at least in my mind, very clearly an effort to reset the negotiation process, which had become stalled. And you saw the messaging coming out of the White House. You saw what he was tweeting in regular language and in all caps. He was saying, we've done this, now come back to the table. And by the way, that's exactly what he's tweeted now. The Iranians, when they were contemplating their options, they really didn't have very many good ones in terms of responses because they could do nothing and they would be seen as provocatively weak by their internal opposition, or they could do something. And if they miscalculated, they could create a catastrophic response from the United States. So what ended up happening was precisely what we saw earlier today, was a punch that was telegraphed well in advance so that so as to minimize any casualty or any, frankly, any destruction of the Al Udeid airbase at all, right? This is, I see this as a face-saving measure on the part of the Iranians. It's not clear to me that they're ready to come back to the negotiating table, but it is clear to me that that's what the administration hopes.
Go ahead, Matt.
You talked about coercive diplomacy and Trump's tweets today, but how do you make sense of his tweet about regime change?
So I think it's all part and parcel. Look, the president campaigned successfully on this idea that he would end wars, right? He has no appetite for regime change. He does not want a nation build. It's very clear, sort of from my conversations with folks in the administration, this is just not on the agenda. What he does want is he wants an agreement that codifies the status quo as he sees it, that it has to be, right? Which is that the Iranian nuclear program is, if not fully dismantled, is in the process of being dismantled in a verifiable fashion, right? And how my sense is, however we get there is how he wants to get there. And I saw that as a I saw that tweet about, you know, make Iran great again. If this regime can't do a deal, then we need one that can, as a sort of signal to the Iranian regime that there is a possibility for escalation on the American side, that this patience is not infinite. And, you know, there are consequences to continued intransigence. And by the way, at least in the context of Iran, this is actually a very useful messaging strategy, because the Iranian negotiating strategy all along has been to run out the clock. They did it successfully for a decade with the Europeans and then with the Obama administration. They ended up coming up with a deal that, you know, according to many, myself included, was overly generous in terms of sanctions relief. It was too limited, didn't cover enough stuff. And so the Iranians have sort of become conditioned to think that, oh, if we just keep talking, then the Americans won't do anything, right? We can only do one thing at a time. So what happened over the weekend, I think, really jolted them awake. And now Trump has signaled that, you know, the Iranian response was, you know, just a face-saving measure. He's willing to move on. The question really is, the ball is back in the Iranian court. You know, are they willing to move on?
Here's my question. I can take at face value the assertion, of course, that Iran is an overarching destabilizing actor in the Mideast, not a good faith actor. I can, of course, I think the historical record about Iran's, what I'm going to just call bad faith, foot dragging, et cetera, pretty robust historical record there. The intervention by the United States, and we'll get into the legal authorities to launch this sort of military attack against a nation state versus a non-state actor and how that's become muddied post 9/11 largely. Yeah, sure. But my question is this. It seems to me that the question of the day, and one that Donald Trump is not really interested in engaging any dialogue about, is whether or not the attack by the United States, the use of these massive penetrator bombs, actually took out Fordo, right? We've seen some footage. We've seen destruction. But the question is, did it actually completely obliterate that? Again, the president's word obliterate, I believe, totally obliterated. What I understand from listening to a lot of military commanders is that prudence is what is most appropriate following this sort of attack until you have verifiable intelligence. Complicating matters further, as I have heard accounts that, again, there were forewarnings of a potential attack, that Iran took measures to move enriched uranium, not quite yet at weapons grade, but near weapons grade, that it could be moved, that it was moved. So the baseline question, Elon, is the president right when he claims that Iran's nuclear sites were, quote, totally obliterated? Or do we really need, and again, Secretary Hegseth, Secretary of State Rubio, much more muted. And in fact, one of the generals said, we have to actually investigate that claim. Does all of this, again, how do we assess that? What is the prudent course when it comes to claims of total obliteration of their nuclear, those particular nuclear sites, including Fordo, the most important of those?
Well, look, so I think there's two things here, right? So we all have the sort of the lived experience that Donald Trump is given to hyperbole and he's given to exaggerating, but we don't, my rule of thumb is you don't take him literally, but you take him seriously, right? And I tend to think that that's right, that time will determine, right? There will be people who will be examining, what happened to the enriched uranium, right? There's things like radiation footprints and things like that that you can track by satellite, right? It takes time. But I tend to think that the Iranian claims that, this was just minor damage, we moved everything beforehand, is simply for their own domestic consumption. Because if you look at what the Israelis were doing in the days ahead of the American strike, their intelligence was so good that they were killing Iranian nuclear scientists by missile strike in their own bedrooms. So the idea that the Israelis could do that, but they couldn't track, hundreds of kilograms of enriched material traveling outside of sensitive sites that they have surveillance over, I simply don't believe it, right? That said, I don't know. I mean, my sense is that a lot has been accomplished, and maybe enough has been accomplished that the president is comfortable saying, you know what, even though we know that it's not fully, fully obliterated, enough damage has been done. Maybe there's a little face saving that needs to be done on the part of the Iranians as well. Maybe let them take the sort of the hyperbole, let them take the quiet win and sort of move on, right? Because after all, he is trying to set the negotiating table again.
I think one of the quotes that I read over the weekend was from Rafael Mariano Grossi, of course, the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying on CNN Sunday that, quote, Iran has made no secret that they have protected this material. I've also heard that there are some, a mild way to put this, places of departure between American and Israeli intelligence when it comes to these matters. When we're talking about military operations, especially the targeting, the specific targeting of nuclear sites, specificity in the actual facts deeply matter, as does the accuracy and reliability of the intelligence gathering here. Can you speak a bit to this distinction? The New York Times reporting, amongst other outlets, that American officials have said that while Israel's intelligence agency believes that Iran can achieve a nuclear weapon in 15 days, the American intelligence apparatus believes that it could take several months and up to a year for Iran to make a weapon, begging the question about the legal authority for the president's attack. We're going to discuss the differences between American and Israeli intelligence, what that means for these sorts of attacks, and the question of the legality of the president's decision to bomb Iran. We continue with our expert, Elon Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council, and my excellent co-host this afternoon, Matt Rothschild. Keep it locked. The big discussions of the big issues continue on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. And welcome if you're just joining us on this steamy Monday afternoon here in the state of Wisconsin and for our listeners beyond. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. On Mondays, I'm joined by a fine guest co-host. His name is Matt Rothschild. You can find his solo work on the podcast Wisconsin Forward, of course, our state's motto. You can find that at civicmedia.us and wherever you listen to podcasts. Matt and I are joined this half hour by Mideast expert Elon Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council. You can check out all of his work at their website, afpc.org. That's afpc.org. Elon, right before the break, I queued up the fact that there has been some difference between American and Israeli intelligence as it relates specifically to how soon could Iran have a nuclear bomb ready to deploy. And so I wanted to ask you, the imminence of the threat, if you start to talk to lawyers who study the, quote, law of war, which is actually a complex set of both international treaties and our own constitutional limitations, and we'll talk hopefully a wee bit about that. But what do you make of that's a pretty significant difference, 15 days or maybe up to a year before they could have a usable nuclear bomb. What do you say about the differences there?
So Again, right. So this is a crucial point, but I think the sort of the broader frame needs to be understood. There are differences about the timeline, but there's not a difference about the direction, right? Both Israel and the United States, both the intelligence communities of both countries are pretty much in lockstep that the Iranians are developing this. And in the context where you have these differences in terms of intelligence estimates, estimates of imminence, right? The country that's the most skittish is the one that drives the pace, right? The Israeli intelligence that the threat was more imminent is what propelled them to move. Now, again, it's going to take years, if at all, for us to see even the majority of the intelligence that the president right. Has sort of has seen in terms of informing his decision making. But I'm pretty comfortable having sort of studied this for, you know, a quarter of a century. I'm pretty comfortable with the general directionality, right? We can quibble over whether it was 2 weeks or 2 months or whatever it is, but the directionality was clear. And the parallel processes that I think are very germane here is it's not just Iran's development of enrichment of uranium. It's not just Iran's development of a nuclear device, right? Because a lot goes into that, right? There's uranium enrichment, there's weaponization, and there's also delivery systems. Correct. So the fact that Iran was ramping up its production of ballistic missiles is also, right? It's not a tangential subject. It's also very important. So my sense is, again, right, like you, Maggie, Matt, I don't know about you, but I'm a recovering lawyer, right? As Maggie, as you are. I teach international law. So I sort of, I'm very steeped in this sort of this idea of preemption and prevention and, you know, the sort of the ambiguities that result, right? Under international law, if you stick to the letter of the UN Charter and sort of the letter of international law, it's restrictive in nature, right? But frankly, so restrictive that it doesn't really meet real world conditions, because most countries do not interpret the right of self-defense as waiting until they're struck and then striking back, but stopping to strike back, you know, ceasing their retaliation as soon as the UN steps in. That seems like a recipe for, you know, predation by sort of more belligerent states, right? There's a much more
And yet it's the UN Charter, right? And the concepts of proportionality, these sorts of things, eminence, scope, absolutely. Scope of impact, what are the nature, scope, duration, right, in terms of right. our own constitutional yeah. framework. Can you speak to that a bit? Again, we've got Representative Massey now under massive attack from right. the MAGA side of the political sure. spectrum. He's saying, listen, we have an Article 1 crisis. Congress didn't even get notice that this was happening. What say you to even the baseline point that there was an obligation of this administration to at least notify members of the intelligence committees of both chambers?
So this is where sort of political practice and standards intersect with sort of with imminence and with the reality of politics, right? Because let's be clear, had Congress been notified, the news of this would have leaked, right? This is sort of the system that we're
well. Then why tell Congress anything, right? They use skips.
No. Look, Congress has the ability and the constitutional duty to, if this becomes a protracted conflict, right? Congress holds the power of the purse. They have the right to bless it with the power of the purse, right? However, if you go back and you look at, say, the Obama administration, right, I can count on the fingers of one hand, right, the number of times, right, there was Pakistan, there was, the strike against bin Laden, all that stuff. All that stuff included episodes that did not involve prior notification for Congress, because sometimes surprise is necessary. So to me, it's not this one moment where Congress was not notified beforehand. It's how we proceed from here, what the balance is between the legislative and executive branches.
Fair enough. And Biden bombed the Houthis, so did Donald Trump. They did so without congressional authorization. Yeah. My question is more basic than that. And that is, given all that has occurred in the post 9/11 environment, which is clearly an expansion of presidential war-making powers, however so defined, whether by the UN Charter or the United States Constitution, which doesn't have a clear definition here, and again, looking at how this Congress has wielded the power of the purse, what checks remain if these sorts of attacks can be leveled against nation states as opposed to non-state actors. Elon, we got to go, but will you come back and we'll have a legal eagle beagle afternoon discussing that.
I would love it. I would love it, although I try to stay away from law as much as possible. But for you, yes, absolutely.
Many thanks, my friend. Now, Matt's got some opinions. So do I, and I bet each and every one of you do. We'll convene the discussion about the Iran conflict when we return, not just after these messages, but at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. Get your thoughts going. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm your host, Maggie Dawn. Hope you are staying cool this Monday afternoon. It is steamy out there. Folks, if you've got elderly neighbors, pregnant folks that you know, people with breathing disorders, please check in on your loved ones and friends when we've got weather that is this hot, this humid, and frankly, after a lukewarm, in literal terms, beginning to June. We've got a fine guest with us for this next half hour. I'm so pleased to have Patrick Farabaugh, the founder and editor of Our Lives, an online publication for Wisconsin's LGBTQ community. If you are interested in discussing the Iran conflict, the Iran bombs, the Iran retaliation, what comes next? Hey, is any of this actually legal or constitutional? Please hold on to your hats. We're going to open up the phone lines. We're going to go to that discussion at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. We're going to give all of you as much time as you want to sound off. I know my fine co-host Matt Rothschild has got a bee in his bonnet, and we're going to make sure he gets that one out. So, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. Let's start with the tough stuff, right? Last week, absolutely terrible week with the Supreme Court deciding that states can basically ban trans care for young people. When you think about how to address matters like that in your publication, Our Lives, what goes through your head? How do you decide what the coverage should be? How do you speak to community when there's so many threats and they seem to be compounding daily?
Yeah, I think that one of the benefits of being an LGBTQ media is that I can speak from, or I shouldn't say not necessarily me, but the writers, the people who are part of the community and platformed by the magazine can sort of speak in community, where when majority media or mainstream media covers stuff, it feels like it's almost talking about a group rather than to a group. So I'm able to talk to a group directly using the language and messaging and understanding to help communicate an issue, I think, more effectively of why it is important, the damage and harm that it can do, the lives that it impacts. And I try to do it in a way that centers the lived experience of trans people. I'm a cisgender person. I'm not trans myself. To make sure that they feel seen and valued and know that somebody's out there trying to protect who they are, what their identity is, and that they are valid in every community that they exist in.
What was your reaction to that Supreme Court decision?
I hate to say it. I'm just not surprised anymore. I expect it. I don't expect a good LGBTQ ruling to come out for who knows how long at this stage, given that there's practically a supermajority, or I don't know if it is technically considered a supermajority on the court, but Alito and Thomas have not signaled that they're willing to rule positively on anything LGBTQ. I keep telling people that it is literally a matter of time before federal marriage equality is overturned.
Really?
I think if I had to guess, 2 to 3 years.
Oof. Wow.
So, you know, and I'm pivoting from the trans stuff, so I don't want to diminish what you were asking about.
Maybe not at all,
the
Patrick.
Marriage equality stuff could be another topic later in the conversation.
The threat is really on all fronts, and I wanted to cue in on something that you were talking about, Patrick, and that is like the idea of speaking from within community, that someone who is of community can communicate in a way that frankly can bring people's threat and their vigilance level down, their threat perception, their vigilance level down. Last week we had Abigail Swetz on Wednesday when the decision dropped, right? And that's an example of trying to do that. On Thursday, we had a group of fabulous Black female leaders on, and I tried to let them speak to one another, right? Mm-hmm. Without getting in the way. If you can unpack that a little bit for people who may not, if pardon me for using this conceptualization, check any boxes. What are the ways that, for example, someone who's cisgendered or who is not a member of the LGBTQIA plus community can communicate to a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, hey, I'm a safe place, and you can talk to me, and how important it is to have mediums like Our Lives, your publication, that allow members of a community to speak to one another, that sense of safety is so crucial to create in these most dangerous times.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for the question. Like, one of the things that I tell people, and I feel like I almost oversimplify it, describing it this way, but if you think of, like, you're taking college French or high school French or Spanish or any foreign language, you have like 101 level, 102 level, 103, right? I feel like the way mainstream media covers queer issues most of the time is checking a box, and it never really goes past that 101 level conversation, which is great for exposure to wider communities to help people begin to learn that trans and queer people exist in their community and help demystify some of the things that I think the far right likes to kind of turn into a boogeyman around LGBTQ people. But it really is important to have a space where you can talk from an LGBTQ perspective to LGBTQ people. So you can go take that conversation farther. Like, to when I mentioned messaging in my first answer, that was kind of what I was referring to, mm-hmm. where you can actually start getting into topics that are like 102, 103, 104, yeah. that have that sort of that cultural competency baseline that just really wouldn't exist when mainstream media is trying to translate LGBTQ issues to who their audience is, where they're talking about LGBT people rather than to LGBT people.
And I think there's something to be said for those who are consider themselves allies, consider themselves people who want to support and elevate different groups mm-hmm. of people. It is really important, I think, to try to get past the introductory level yeah. of safe and respectful communication. I often tell people I never want to be captured by the limits of my understanding of how to communicate, because I hope that yeah. my intention always comes through. But I'm always open to be learning how to communicate more effectively and compassionately with people that come from different lived experience backgrounds. And I really appreciate yeah. you elevating that.
I think another important thing there is whenever someone from a majority group is speaking to someone in a marginalized group, the reality is you're more there to listen than you yes. are to speak. Like, you have to kind of acknowledge that maybe it's not about you in that case, and listen to the other person and give them an opportunity to educate you on what that language is or how to speak about a topic, or maybe why some of the political and cultural positions have evolved to where they're at. You know, there was a great moment that went viral during the last round of anti-trans sports bills in the Wisconsin Capitol, where there was this really old school Wisconsin cisgender man, straight man, farmer.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Please continue.
He came in to support the anti-transgender legislation. And while he was sitting, waiting for his turn to speak at the public hearings, had managed to have multiple conversations with trans people there who were there to speak, obviously, in opposition to him. And, you know, it goes back to that changing hearts and minds. I think that was maybe his first time engaging with anybody who identified as trans, and very quickly got his eyes opened, realizing that the perception that he had just didn't match the reality that was in front of him that day. So ended up speaking out against the bills once his turn came.
Really? That's an amazing transformation in a short period of time.
Yeah, it was incredible.
I know we've got the audio somewhere in the files, Jacob. If you can check out Dropbox, because if we can find it, or just Google, I think it's like 82-year-old Wisconsin farmer man changes mind on trans. I mean, I played the audio because the man's testimony was so moving. Yes.
Yeah.
And he did. And here was the thing that I thought was incredibly empowering. There are two things about one, that minds can be changed when you are open to listening to someone else's lived experience.
Yeah.
And two, he got up and said it, and he didn't worry about saying it perfectly.
Yeah, that was another thing that I thought was remarkable. Like, I had watched that clip over and over. I was there that day in person, too.
Yeah.
But specifically, I would not, if you haven't seen the clip, I think it's easy to jump to, well, maybe this person's rural, but progressive still. I don't think he was progressive. I think he was probably at his core raised as a, as red-blooded red as somebody can get. You know, the issue, I think, and what I've been trying to tell younger queer people now is a lot of the ways that these trans issues are being spoken about is almost a direct copy and paste of how the GOP spoke about gay and lesbian people,
yes,
you know, back at the peak of the AIDS crisis and then in the early stages of the movement for marriage equality. You know, they tried to use the same language, that pedophile language or that sexual pervert or all, to scare people. You know, when the marriage amendment back in 2006 passed, Fair Wisconsin had done a postmortem on why the average Wisconsin voter voted in favor of banning same-sex marriage. So, you know, to the point of enshrining it in the Wisconsin Constitution. And what they found out was the average voter that voted yes did not believe that they actually knew anyone, right, LGBTQ. It's really easy to make a marginalized group, especially a group like trans people that are maybe 1% of the population,
yep,
the boogeyman, because there's just not enough of them to fight back on that big of a bully pulpit that these elected leaders have.
But I do think more and more families are experiencing what it is to have a trans person in their family. And so the great nonviolent revolution that was the gay rights revolution is going to have the same effect with trans people too.
Absolutely. There's also like a movement, an in community movement, where it's like, does the T belong with LGBTQ, right? Mm-hmm. And because one is about sexuality, one is about gender. And the reality is trans people were there for LGB people through every step, yes, of achieving any sort of legal rights. It's our obligation. We are tethered together. It doesn't exist without. This is our time to make sure that we're there for them. And I say that as a cisgender queer person.
And I think that distinction between sexuality and gender and what that means is the boogeyman that is used by so many is to conflate the two, right? And to not engage in some of the difficult discussions that attend to what someone's gender identity is, how it's defined, what our culture places as normative or sort of presumptively how we're going to define genders. Because as I said with Abigail last week, in every bit of recorded human history, there is recordation of transgendered people. Every bit, every culture, every corner of the globe, trans folks exist. They're in every corner of our communities, and they need to be loved and embraced and elevated, not denigrated and fear-mongered for some weird political end. We've got to take a little bit of a break. I'm going to be back with Patrick Farabaugh. He is the editor and creator of Our Lives, a publication that focuses on LGBTQIA+ folks here in Wisconsin. I got Matt Rothschild riding along with me this Monday afternoon. Keep it locked right here. We're going to come back, re-engage this conversation. What can you do in your community to help support the LGBTQ community? Stay tuned.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. This is The Maggie Dawn Show. Did you ever wonder, what do Maggie and her fine guests talk about during the breaks? Do they have interesting things that we don't get to hear on the air? The answer is probably yes. And if you want to see the secret show behind the show behind the show, then you need to watch us on YouTube on Civic Media's wonderful YouTube channel. You can also check out at Maggie Dawn Show on Instagram and Facebook and the X. and watch us there. And we've got a great guest this afternoon. It's Patrick Faribault, editor, creator, and writer for Our Lives, an online LGBTQIA plus publication here in Wisconsin. I've got Matt Rothschild with me, a fine guest co-host this Monday afternoon. Patrick, you were explaining something that I thought was incredibly important from the political lens through which these issues are addressed. And that is what? We were using this construct of knowing how to talk about, like, the basic intro is like a 101 level, and then you end up in like the 400 levels when you're in graduate school. Please explore that metaphor a little bit more, because I think it was quite apt.
Yeah, I think a lot of the media attention that go on to freshman congresspersons, you know, goes to the people like Jasmine Crockett, but Sarah McBride's also got quite a bit. Sarah is the first openly trans member of Congress, and there was a bit of national news when Nancy Mace was trying to ban Sarah from being able to use bathrooms in the Capitol, which is its own level of crazy. One of the things that I found kind of fascinating, and I'm sure this can be searchable and found pretty quickly as well, in the past week or two, Sarah was giving an interview, a national interview, where she was talking about how one of the challenges the Democratic Party has done that I think feed into how the right has weaponized the word woke against the left has been that the Dems kind of jumped to trans 104 in their messaging, right? That higher level. And the reality was, we kind of skip past trans 101 and helping the country just learn what, like, fundamental human decency is around trans people before we jump into the minutia about some cultural issues that are unique to the trans experience. Another thing that I thought was kind of fascinating that a lot of people wouldn't know is Sarah is a widow. She was married for some time, and her husband is from Wisconsin. I think her husband was from the Fox Valley specifically, but it's given her an affinity for this part of the country, and she's traveled here often. I've met and worked with her personally because of how often she's come here.
That's wonderful. I hope, Patrick, do let us know the next time she's in town, because I know we would love to have her here on Civic Media. We've got the clip of the 85-year-old gentleman or 82-year-old gentleman who attended the hearing for an anti-trans bill that was introduced in the last legislative cycle. He was there to speak in favor of the anti-trans legislation. But after listening to the testimony and talking with some of the people that were there to testify as well, his heart and minds were opened and changed. Heart and mind were opened and changed. Let's take a listen.
So, all right, Larry, the floor is yours. You got 2 minutes.
First of all, I'd like to apologize to you people. I was invited here to give my support for Bill 401. I have very little knowledge of gay people and things like that there. So when I came here, my eyes were open. I was one of the critics that sat on the side and made the decisions that was only two genders. So I got an education that was unbelievable. And I don't know just exactly how to say this, but my perspective for people have changed. So I don't want to take up no more of your time. I'd like to apologize for being here, and I learned a very lot about this group of people.
If an 82-year-old guy here in Wisconsin can be humble enough to listen, can't we all? It still, like, gets me choked up listening to him talk.
Yeah.
Right? Like, not perfect, but heartfelt, open, and humble.
I think it goes back to that expression that it's hard to hate up close, right?
Yes.
It's so much easier to have conversations about people who aren't in the room and create this perception or this narrative that just kind of dissolves once you actually meet and get to know someone who is marginalized based on however you're discriminating in, whether it's by gender, by race, by sexuality, by fill in the blank with any marginalized group.
Hard to hate.
I really
up close.
Admired his ability to have an open mind and then to admit that he was wrong.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful.
I'm so, like, saying I'm sorry is so moving. We've got one of our frequent listeners and callers, L.A. Tom. Say hello to Patrick and Matt. And what would you like to share this afternoon?
Hey, Patrick. Hey, Matt. Hey, Maggie. First, I actually own the gayandlesbianpages.com in Southern California. We are the number one directory in Southern California. And the purpose for it was growing up in Wisconsin in a small town called Durand. My dad being a head football coach, and he playing sports myself all the way through college. I was very, very close to killing myself when I was in college at St. Norbert. When I came out, and I called one of the helplines, like we, have the Trevor Project and things like that. But it was actually a hotline in Wisconsin, and I spoke for probably about 8 hours to a guy on the phone, and he talked me off the ledge in terms of actually going through it and killing myself. And and then when I moved to LA and moved away from the smaller towns and things like that, I actually decided to own my own directory that would actually be able to help people, with their process of coming out. But the reason I say that is, one, these things are so important, but one thing that's really important too for us in the LGBTQ+ community is to get out and just come out and let people see our authentic selves. And get to know your neighbors and basically go door to door. That's how we won with marriage equality. People started seeing us as actual, their brothers and sisters, their doctors, their lawyers, everyone else in the community.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thank you, Patrick Faribault, creator of Our Lives, an online publication for Wisconsin's LGBTQ community.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.